You know how important it is to ensure that your supplements are genuine, safe, and effective. That's why I partnered with Fullscript, an online dispensing platform that only offers curated professional-grade brands I know and trust, the very same supplements that I prescribe to my patients and take myself. Never counterfeit or expired, always stored and shipped correctly. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com to start your free Fullscript account. Buying through Fullscript offers fast shipping, optional refill reminders, a mobile-friendly site. It's safe, secure, and HIPAA-compliant and offers world-class support. Fullscript also gives you access to my custom-targeted supplement protocols that combine the products that I recommend to address specific needs, heart health, immune support, and much more. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com to sign up for your free Fullscript account. You'll get access to the supplements and features you need to help you achieve your wellness goals. That's DearHoffmanStore.com. DearHoffmanStore.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast, Part 2, continuing our discussion of some new and innovative ways to screen for cancer. You know, we have a lot of ways to screen for cardiovascular risk, but when it comes to cancer, we have some tests that are, not so great. They can sometimes show cancer is present when it's not. They're false positives. They miss a lot of cancers. Some of the tests like colonoscopy are a little onerous. People avoid them. Mammograms, similarly. We are now in the era where we can actually do blood tests for cancer. And leading the charge is Grail. That's an appropriate name for a company that's trying to crack the code on cancer, like the Holy Grail. They have a test called the Galleri test, which is being offered by some physicians. Today, we're going to talk to continue our discussion with Gary Goldman, who is a functional medicine expert, but also board-certified OBGYN here in New York with Weill Cornell. He has a center of his own here in New York. Gary, give out the information about your center. And you can go if you're a man, right? Because you do functional medicine for men and women, but focus on women's care.
Right. So, I started off as a straightforward OBGYN. Our center has grown over the years, and I decided it once I was doing functional medicine for a number of years. It was time to see the fellas back, and it's been great to welcome them. I think a lot of them have endocrinologic issues because they've got hair on their chest and such, but we can cure it.
you just turn them right back into the females so they just are appropriately OBGYN, right? I think hormonal, there's menopause and you do a lot of work with menopause, but men encounter age-related hormonal changes. It requires skill to address those with testosterone and other methods too. And of course, lifestyle to support that transition. So coming back to our subject, you had me at 89% because it's a test that's 89% for picking up a cancer. But I got to tell you about my experience in the 1980s with a proposed cancer test called the AMAS test. You may be familiar with that, but it was a bit of a fiasco because the AMAS test was a test that purported, like the Galleri test, to identify cancer. The only problem is it didn't tell you where the cancer was. And I was conservative about it. I said, I'm not on board. I mean, it sounds great, but I'm not on board because I can foresee problems. And indeed, I remember a colleague calling me one day saying, Ron, I got a problem. I need your advice. I said, okay, what happened? He said, I have a patient who has schizophrenia. Okay. And we did the cancer screening test, that new AMAS test on her, and it was positive. And now we've had to tell the patient that the patient has cancer, but we have no idea where it is. And we've done enormous amounts of screening on her. We've imaged every millimeter of her body. We've done, we've scoped her fore and aft. We can't find the cancer. She also has a mental disorder, which makes her extremely agitated to think that cancer is within her body, but we can't find the cancer. I said, that is a terrible dilemma. I didn't really know how to advise him because the test wasn't really ready for prime time. The Galleri test appears to be better suited because of, greater accuracy, possibly greater specificity, not showing up cancer when cancer is not present, but also directing people, diagnosticians to where the cancer might lie to arrive at a better conclusion. So let's explore what some of the challenges are here, because British Medical Journal published an article recently that criticizes the effort in the UK under the auspices of the National Health Service, which is strapped for funds. So I'm happy to hear that Grail paid for this. They didn't rely on the public till in an already overburdened National Health Service. It's a £150 million Grail-funded trial involving more than 100,000 people in England, and they're going to do the test on them, and they're going to see if in a real-world circumstance it pays off. But there's some controversy around it, because some people are saying it ain't ready for prime time. So can you delve into the controversy and break it down for us?
Sure. So, you know, the studies that originally allowed Grail to come to market included the Pathfinder, and that's the first clinical study, and before that was the CCGA 1, 2, and 3. So there's a series of publications. They are in the process of collecting data on an additional three or four, I think. The largest one is through the National Health Service in Great Britain. 140,000 people are being tested annually over 3 years. Its main goal is to answer some questions that have not yet been answered. So what has been answered? Will Grail find cancers? Yes. Will it be able to identify them with very little in the way of false positives? Yes, the false positive rate is 0.5%. Very impressive.
Wow.
Okay.
Half a percent.
Yeah, so one in 200. So okay. When it finds a cancer is there. Now, they chose, you know, sensitivity and specificity are by design, and one occurs at the expense of the other.
Right.
So they were facing a philosophical dilemma. What do we want, sensitivity or specificity? Mm-hmm. And they decided to go with specificity. They wanted it specifically a cancer. They did not want to tell people you have a cancer and for it to be wrong. Okay. So because of that, they left at the docks the sensitivity. So it's not as sensitive as it could have been designed, but it's highly specific to avoid freaking people out.
I'm thinking of an analogy here is that if you go to a dermatologist and they're really gung-ho dermatologists, the dermatologist who biopsies every single blemish, sunspot on your skin, they're going to have a high degree of sensitivity, right? They won't miss anything.
Right, but they'll have no
sensitivity. They'll have no specificity because they will be biopsying unnecessarily. Okay,
exactly. So we know that it's great at picking up cancers. What don't we know? We don't know. Number one, does that make a difference?
Right.
Okay. In theory, you know, when you first start doing mammograms in the population, some people are going to have stage one cancers, some are going to have stage fours. And when you first start doing these tests, the death rate is going to be X because you're looking at a mixture of people early stage and late stage.
Right.
When you continue to do mammograms every year, all those late stage folks have now aged out through the process. Now you're only picking up early breast cancers. So the outcome data starts to look much, much better when people are utilizing these tests on a regular basis.
Interesting.
That's the same concern here. When you're finding early and late stage cancers all mixed together, the outcome data is going to be mixed. Mm-hmm. You got to follow people long enough.
When you say outcome data, the outcome data means lives prolonged or lives saved. Is that what we're talking about?
Well, you know, ultimately,
survival.
Right. You want to look at survival on these cancers. So that's what they're hoping to achieve in Great Britain is by following these people over years, can you start to pick out many more of the early stage cancers where you can show that you're making a difference. Mm-hmm. Right? Because now it's stage ones instead of a mixture of stage one through four. And when you're finding everybody at a stage one, we know epidemiologically mm-hmm. that you find all cancers across the board. You got 100 different cancers right. plus. Right. If you look at all the stage ones, there's about an 80% 5-year survival. Mm-hmm. But the time it's metastatic disease, stage three and four,
to the liver, the lungs, et cetera, the bones. Yeah.
Right. 20% lifelong survival. So yep. 5-year survival. So clearly we have to show that. Right? It makes sense we're going to find many more mm-hmm. stage ones over the course of time. And it makes sense there'll be a better recovery rate and cure rate and greater longevity, but you've got to show it.
Right.
So that's really the crux of the argument.
Of the real world trial. So right. to put it a little more brutally, there are several instances. One is where we find the cancer, but it's too late anyway, because maybe with the technology of 2075, we'll be able to cure that cancer. But at present time, you have a very small chance of surviving anyway. And so that may be reflected in survival and maybe disease-free survival is a quality of life, even though you may not survive, but that's important, but it may be too late to save the person. The other instance, kind of interesting, is that it's been suggested, and I think there's some science that backs up, and certainly in prostate cancer, this is the case, maybe in breast cancers, that there are cancers that develop. There are spontaneous mutations that cause small loci of cancer to develop within the prostate, perhaps within the breast. But then the body's immune system copes with them and they regress. Or alternatively, they're slow growing that they would kill you at the age of 129. And that that detecting them and aggressively treating them isn't worth the effort and also the consternation that it may cause the person. So these are a couple of instances. And then there's, of course, the concern with false positives. You've addressed that because, with many tests, especially the mammogram, there are a lot of false positives. And a lot of women undergo biopsies and they undergo the stress associated with that, indeed, it turns out they don't have cancer.
Right. So let's talk about these in more detail. So I want to be fully transparent here. When people get that positive signal on Galleri, what are the odds that the initial evaluation is going to find the cancer? And the answer is about 44%.
And Say that again. Why is it so low?
But what are the odds that on the initial workup, we're going to find that cancer?
Oh,
all right. Just finished telling you there's only a 0.5% false positive.
I see.
The problem is finding these very early cancers.
I see.
So when they're super early,
yeah,
it may be too small to be visualized.
I see.
I'll find that on a pelvic sonogram, mm-hmm. the smallest thing you can legitimately identify is about 1 centimeter. Mm-hmm. Similarly on mammogram, right? So smaller than that, you may not be able to find it.
Wow.
We follow those people very closely,
yeah.
and actually GRAIL covers for free a follow-up study 3 to 6 months later if the initial evaluation could not find the cancer.
Okay, which makes sense because, that could be that 1 in 20 instance, the 1 in 200 instance of a false positive.
It could be a false positive.
Right.
Or it could be to the point that you just made eloquently, which is that your immune system's job is to find right. and destroy cancers. I don't know about you. I learned in medical school we make another cancer every day, but our immune system is so good that it's killing it off.
Right.
So it's being killed, it's shedding its DNA, Galleri's picking it up. So it could just be a true cancer that your body's in the process of removing. Mm-hmm. There, the follow-up study would be expected to be negative.
Right. Well, have you seen that clinically? That people in a way get vindicated.
No, but it's been shown.
Okay.
It's been
okay.
So there's the ones that initially are positive and subsequently turn negative. Mm-hmm. It could also be that the workup wasn't complete. So here's a for instance.
Yeah.
And this was one of the studies that actually happened. So patient came in and she had a positive test, and it said, looks like head and neck, but can't rule out cervix. So okay. It meant
because the tissue in some ways is similar, epithelial tissue, right?
And exactly,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I remember the in histology in medical school, how, you know, the for instance, the vagina and the esophagus are look identical under the microscope. Very, very subtle differences. Anyway.
Well, they're tubes, basically. So there you go.
So head and neck and cervix look very, very similar. So that's the way the report came out. And this patient was sent for evaluation, both by ENT and by gynecology, and it was all negative. So fast forward, it was about 5 months later, she went for repeat testing, and it was still positive. She went back to both of those specialists, and it was still negative for workup. So then they put on their thinking caps, and they thought, wait a minute, what do cancers of the head and neck and cervix have in common? And I hope some of your listeners will understand HPV disease.
Thank you. Yes. And
HPV.
You might explain that connection because it's not obvious to people who
human papillomavirus right. is the main cause, if not the only cause, of cervical mm-hmm. cancer, as well as vulvar. And I'm actually the author of a study looking at Bartholin duct cancer, a mucus secreting organ at the front of the vagina, also we found associated with HPV.
And Michael Douglas, I believe, was the celebrity case for that, you know, because he was a non-smoker, or perhaps he had smoked, but he attributed it to sexual contact.
Exactly. He was giving oral sex to a woman who had genital HPV. Mm-hmm. I believe that that was the source. And that actually is plausible. Doesn't mean don't have oral sex, but you know the rate of transmission in that regard is very, very low.
And that's reassuring to hear.
Yeah, thank you. So at any rate, they put on their thinking caps and they thought, okay, cervix and head and neck have HPV in common. Any other tissues involved in HPV-related cancers? And the answer there is sure, anorectal cancer.
There, yes, indeed.
Anorectal, think yep. Farrah Fawcett.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's how she went. So, sure enough, they did a sigmoidoscopy and there was the mass.
Yeah. And the relative preponderance of that in men who have sex with men, and especially if they're immunosuppressed with HIV, that is something that comes up. So, yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. So she had anorectal cancer
right.
then.
But, yeah. But that's where the relationship of the cellular machinery as epigenetically determined really comes into play, right? So even when the report helps you along to the tune of 89%, you still need to use your doctor's cap and think in a smart way.
Okay, so Galleri test, and presumably, you know, this is a large language learning model, and presumably they're improving and refining this test continually, right?
This is not the last version. This
right.
is, I think, the second clinical version, and they're in the midst of Pathfinder 2,
right.
Which is ongoing throughout the country, including here at Cornell.
Okay, so this trial is ongoing in the UK, and,
yes.
you know, of course, there it's a big consideration is cost containment because it, you know, essentially is a government-sponsored healthcare system. They want to see if it's practical, if it saves lives, and if it's cost-efficient. Because, you know, they don't want a test that generates a lot of strain on the NHS to hunt down cancers that ultimately, you know, are hard to find or are inconsequential, don't make a difference outcomes. So I guess that's the crux of this experiment that's ongoing. And when will we have the results of that? It's a 3-year trial, I understand.
Right. So they've completed the trial. So they are now in the process of collecting and reviewing the data. They'll have to subject it to statistical analyses and then go through the publication process. I'm hopeful that over the next year and a half, we'll have the data from this. We have, as I pointed out, we have a lot of questions. Number one, is this changing the long-term prognosis? Because while it sure sounds like it should, I can't say that it does because mm-hmm. it hasn't yet been studied and published. Secondly, is this useful for working people up who have cancer-like symptoms? Somebody with weight loss, night sweats, myalgias, and so forth, where the workup is otherwise negative, that sounds like a cancer.
Is it good for blood cancers, by the way? Because it's a little bit different breed of cat, you know, for like lymphomas and leukemias.
Short answer, yes, but only to the tune of about 50% sensitivity.
I see. Okay.
Some of them, I think plasma cell cancers better, but they have
like multiple myeloma kind of thing.
Sensitivity because there's an overwhelming amount of signals coming from the bloodstream when you're doing a blood test, as you might imagine. So they had to tune down the sensitivity. Interesting. So another big question is, can this be utilized to follow people who have had a diagnosis of cancer?
Right.
Is there a recurrence?
Mm-hmm.
So they're trying to gather all of this data from the British study, right? So it's you know, we have to start thinking outside of the box, not just for asymptomatic screening in a higher risk population, which is its current utility, right? But for all these other indications.
Right. So this is another a corollary to this is, okay, let's say you've had cancer but detected by whatever means, perhaps by traditional means, and, you know, you get treatment, whatever, surgery, chemo, radiation, immunotherapy, you know, natural lifestyle, et cetera. And, but, you know, you're on pins and needles because, you know, before, I mean, you ring the bell when you're finished with the treatment, but then the clock starts ticking. You know, 1 year, 2 years, 5 year survival, you know, 10, 15 year survival. And I know what it's like for cancer survivors is that they feel like they have no, it's kind of they're waiting for the other shoe to drop. And the methods for detecting the occurrence of cancer, you know, by the time it's, it, you can see it on imaging, it's going to be a big cancer. So is there potential for this test or other tests that are specially adapted to do this? And I know they're already doing this. They're doing this as a way of determining whether people need follow-up treatment.
Right. So, yes, that's part of this NHS study out of Great Britain. In the original studies, the CCGA and Pathfinder, specifically, people who had a diagnosis of cancer within the last 3 years were excluded from the study because they didn't know for how long do these signals persist. And we don't want to have a lot of
contaminated
information. But by making it a more pure test in that regard, it lost its ability to follow people for cancers and seek information about recurrence. That's another part of the current study in Great Britain.
Okay. But it, do say you have a patient who's had breast cancer successfully treated. Would you use the Galleri test? Or not, because you say that it, the cancer signal can persist even after the cancer has been eradicated.
Right. So, so we don't know that, but that was the anticipated potential problem.
Okay.
So to get rid of that, they waited 3 years from the time of diagnosis. So if I have a patient today who was diagnosed with breast cancer 2 years prior, I would discourage her from having the test at present, because I would, just like a 21-year-old, I would say, I have no data.
Yeah.
I have no data on its utility. And if I find a positive signal, I can't tell you at this stage.
Right.
Is that a recurrence or is that persistence? I have no way of knowing.
I understand there are other tests on the market that are actually approved for following up on certain cancers, or am I mistaken?
Well, the ones we talked about before, PSA and CA125.
I'm talking about a liquid biopsy test for follow-up.
Oh, so no, I'm not familiar.
Okay. I think that there's some that are overseas that, patients that I've referred patients to, out of Germany, out of, European countries that allow that. And that is underway. I can't attest to the prognostic accuracy of those tests, but they are available. Okay, so let's switch gears to another thing, which is, so I think people are well aware of the cancer risk factor blood tests that are genetic tests. And maybe you can explain how they're different, like BRCA1, BRCA2. But now there's a whole series of these tests. And with our improved understanding of genetics plus machine learning and AI, maybe we can take like a pastiche of like 50 different markers and, you know, figure out how the patterns can predict risk. Is that on the launch pad?
So those are in the clinic as we speak. So there's two kinds of tests. We'll call them gross disease and subtle disease. So let's go through gross disease first. And these are
I'd rather have a subtle disease. If I had a choice, I'll take subtle.
Always. So first, let's talk about major cancer genes. So the first one that people think about, that I think about, is BRCA. Now, when I was a little pup, it was just the test was BRCA. And then it became, just kidding, there's BRCA1 and BRCA2. So we started looking at two different BRCA genes. And those are very important because they increase somebody's baseline risk of breast cancer, which is about 12% across the population, to instead about 80% in the worst of situations. So, I mean, that's a horrible statistic.
But it's not an all or nothing. Aren't there certain variations of the patterns of the BRCA that some are more pathogenic and others are less? And you kind of have to read the tea leaves a little bit.
So there are other genes that interact at the level of the BRCA receptor. For instance, PALB2, which interacts at the BRCA1 receptor, with the BRCA1 complex. There's another one called RAD50 that interacts also with this complex.
So these are mitigating or exaggerating factors, additive or subtracting.
So it depends. So generally people have a problem with one or the other gene. Very unusual to find somebody who has both.
Okay.
So for instance, as I said, BRCA will convey upwards of about a 80% lifetime risk of breast cancer, while PALB2, if that's the sole mutation, only conveys a 35% lifetime risk. Mm-hmm. So it's important, but not as much. RAD50, non-quantifiable. It's a smaller number. But they all interact together. It's a giant DNA repair grouping. It's all these proteins that glom together and ride the chromosome and repair the DNA.
Right.
And when that repair mechanism is defective, depending on where it's defective, it has more or less of an impact.
Are the cancer promoter and the cancer suppressor genes different and distinct? And can they be measured?
Those are primarily as determined by methylation.
Okay.
That's where the epigenetics comes in.
I see.
And that's where susceptibility is built around. This is horrifying. Life events. You know, we learned back in high school biology that nothing is heritable other than through your DNA. And it turns out wrong. So your grandparent who was in Auschwitz, who was subjected to such terrible stress, that stress altered the way their DNA is going to be transcribed. And that alteration lasts about three generations.
Right. So the Bible is right. The sins of the fathers shall be visited upon the children up to, I think, the Bible says four generations or something like that.
Yeah, the Bible foresaw epigenetics.
Wow. Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah.
It's
heritable characteristics. Yeah. Fascinating.
Okay. So let's say somebody comes to you and says, I want a soup to nuts valuation. I want, you know, cholesterol and LDL particles, and I want LPA and C-reactive protein, and I want to check my insulin and my hemoglobin A1C. And then on the cancer front, could you please run a complete genetic profile on my, I'm fine now, but I want to find out if I'm destined to develop cancer. Are we at that stage?
Yeah, 100%. So let's, again, that goes back to the first question. Let's talk about the major cancer gene screening. So the company that...
Because I see there are panels now available.
Yes,
I understand.
Yeah. Yes. So the main company that first came out with BRCA testing, can I use the name of a company?
Of course.
Okay. Yeah. Was Myriad Genetics.
Uh-huh.
They started offering ultimately a myriad of options, and they refer to their panel as MyRisk. Currently, their MyRisk panel is, I think, 46 genes.
Oh, okay.
They're looking for genes that code for increased risk of colon cancer, pancreatic, ovary, breast, you name it.
Yeah.
Right? They're all incorporated in this panel.
I think there's a specific one for colon cancer, which is a Gardner syndrome. Is that is there a gene for that?
Lynch syndrome.
Lynch syndrome. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so that can be picked up.
Yeah.
And interestingly, that codes for both colon and endometrial cancer.
Okay.
So we manage people who have one of these syndromes individually to the risks conveyed by that particular gene. Doesn't mean you need universal giant cancer screening, but let's say if you're at risk for colon and endometrial cancer, which is a form of uterine cancer, those areas are going to be very much under observation for the foreseeable future. Now,
so you know, as in the movie, the famous line, you know, is, can you handle the truth? And do you do a pretty detailed informed consent with patients? Like, Do you really want to know? Are you psychologically prepared to absorb this information should it be adverse?
So Ron, I run into patients who say, I don't want to know anything.
Yes.
I run into patients who want to know everything.
Ostriches versus whatever. Yeah.
Right. The know-it-alls. Mm-hmm. And lots of folks in between. You know, I think if you have a close friend, family member who has really suffered through a terrible cancer illness or death, that's an inspiration. You don't want to recapitulate that story. And if there's an opportunity to find out what you carry and know that you need to be particularly concerned about this organ system, right? So you can do lots of screening for it. For instance, Galleri, or there's NIH-funded national studies that are being performed all the time. That so, for instance, pancreatic, right? What do you do for if you're at increased risk of pancreatic? PS, that includes BRCA. BRCA increases rate of pancreatic eightfold. Mm-hmm. So that's part of our concerns with BRCA carriers. But these NIH-funded programs can, free of charge, do things like transesophageal sonograms, annual MRIs, CA19-9 blood tests, and even more experimental things that can be utilized in screening people and also in testing. Does this extra screening yield a better outcome? The same kind of question that Galleri is trying to answer vis-a-vis the National Health Service, right? So it's always a big question. Does extra screening yield a better prognosis?
Do you find in a functional medicine practice that this can be a motivational tool, like a teachable moment to get patients to really pay attention to lifestyle factors? You know, we know that exercise, we know that sleep patterns and certainly diet and perhaps certain supplements have an impact on the likelihood of cancer. Do you wield this test, like put it on your refrigerator door with a kitchen magnet and look at this result? And so, you know,
so Ron, it's not just for genetics, it's also for things like dementia, right?
That's
elderly mom is developing Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. Am I destined to do that too? Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, we can run an APOE4 test. Mm-hmm. So, you know, am I therefore destined? Are there things I can do that prevent it?
And almost nothing is 100%. Nothing is even an APOE4 gene is statistically higher risk, but it's not the crack of doom. It's modifiable.
Thank you for pointing that out. But what else can we do? We know exercise is a strong preventative. Mm-hmm. We know that alcohol use promotes Alzheimer's. So there's two big changes in lifestyle that are easy to adopt. And sometimes people need motivation to do both of those, right? Now, what about this week? Big study came out looking at omega-3 fish oil in APOE4 carriers, statistically significantly reduced the risk of developing Alzheimer's in those higher risk
groups. And interestingly, in the non-carriers, no biggie. It was not that, it didn't reach statistical significance, but that's because, you know, it's kind of like, you know, if you give Viagra to the average 25-year-old, will you see an improvement in their sexual performance? They're already performing pretty well, but you take someone who is 75, okay. So, yeah.
The same sensitivity, specificity issue we were discussing earlier.
Right. Gary, this is running long, but this is a fascinating discussion. With your permission, with the permission of our audience, I'm going to ask you a few more questions. Are you okay with that?
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Because I'm really enjoying our discussion, and you're so expert at fielding some of our important questions.
Really ramped up too.
Yeah, good. Okay, so when it comes to breast cancer screening, the mammogram has some problems, because especially with specificity and sensitivity, it misses some cancers, and it also sometimes says that something's suspicious when it's not. Now, you attend these conferences. Presumably you go to OBGYN conferences and you are doing lifetime learning, catching up to all the latest trends. Are they doing anything to enhance breast cancer detection with either a souped up mammogram or maybe, some ancillary tests that can increase its predictive value?
Yes. So the standard mammogram on film turned out to really be a dinosaur. We moved over to digital mammograms about 15, 20 years ago, mm-hmm. much, much more precise and a heck of a lot easier for the radiologists to read and to share with other doctors too. So digitalization was a big plus. Then came tomosynthesis, and that's utilizing extra imaging for refinement of the images that we can see.
Okay.
So that's really useful. Then what we found, and this actually came from a New York group, was that women who were built very dense, either extremely dense or heterogeneously dense, the two highest grades of density, that those women are A, at higher risk of developing breast cancers, and B, it's harder to find them.
It could be missed, yeah, because the surrounding tissue resembles the cancer, yeah.
So this group decided, let's add sonograms and see if that helps. And they brought the false negative rate of mammograms, right? When there's truly a cancer, what are the odds the mammogram is going to miss it? Is 10 to 15%. Mm-hmm. That's a real number. So they added, by adding the sonogram, they brought that number down to 3%.
Wow.
So women with dense breasts, that's really a boon.
Right.
Now, what about MRIs?
Right.
Even better. The false negative rate of MRIs is 0.9%.
Okay. But it's a more burdensome, expensive test.
And the problem is, because it's so sensitive, it's less specific.
Okay. It's going to pick up all kinds of aberrations.
Oh, my God. Frequently on MRIs, first MRI, everything is lighting up. Yeah. It could be this, that, or the other thing.
Yeah.
We want an MRI-guided biopsy. It's the Pandora's box.
Yeah. So I actually was just at a party this weekend with a breast cancer radiologist, a breast radiologist. And she's in the twilight of her career. She's, in the next few years, she's going to retire, but she enjoys it because of the innovations that she's seeing. She says they're using machine learning and AI now because the human eye, and the human brain are limited in their ability to synthesize all that information. So sometimes you actually get image reading. Now, you're going to have the human thing where humans are going to check these results. We can't just hand this over to machines, but that's in the works, right?
Yeah, and that's being used for decades in pap smears. And it's also been utilized throughout histology for cancer diagnoses. Mm-hmm. It's used in radiology for imaging interpretation. It's not just a thing of the future. It's a thing of the present.
Right. So let's talk briefly about colon cancer, because we mentioned that, it used to be, either get a colonoscopy or get one of these things, a fecal occult blood test, an FOBT, where, if you had the blood on the little slide that you put your poop sample on, you take a little, wipe the toilet paper on that, and it would light up if there was blood there. The only problem is, if you had a little, erectile tear, if the toilet paper was too rough, or you had a hemorrhoid, then you would be consigned to a colonoscopy. So that's not so great. So then they came up with the Cologuard. Why is the Cologuard better? And now there's a blood test?
Right. So let's go through those. So if, there's also the virtual colonoscopy.
Right.
So
which sounds great,
It sounds great, but it's a ton of radiation, right? And subject yourself.
Plus, still have to, don't they insufflate you with air? It's still invasive in a sense. They pump you up like a balloon.
Right. You still have to do the prep. They pump you up with air. You get all the irradiation. And if they see something, then you need a colonoscopy.
Anyway. Okay. So I was really big on that virtual colon. I thought that was great about 20 years ago, but.
Right. So then when Cologuard came out, at first glance, it sounded fantastic. 92% sensitivity for finding colon cancers, which is darn good.
Yeah.
Right. But it has to be repeated every 3 years. To me, this is the more important part. It only picks up 47% of the polyps.
Uh-huh.
And we know polyps are the precursor lesion to the colon cancer.
Sometimes, not inevitably, but some are. Yeah.
Right, some are. But if you see a polyp and you remove it, you prevent the cancer.
Right.
So
it's both diagnostic and preventive to get it out.
Right. Well, if you do the colonoscopy, you have the opportunity to prevent the colon cancer by looking for and removing those polyps. That benefit is lost through Cologuard.
Right. And this is an impartial opinion because you don't do colonoscopies. So I'm talking to the fix might be on if a gastroenterologist said, you know, that is still their bread and butter. And they still support that. But okay, now there's a blood test. So isn't that going to drive all those poor gastroenterologists out of business?
Blood tests had similar numbers, but not quite as good as Cologuard. I think it was an 88% sensitivity. This came out in New England Journal a couple of months ago. And it was, again, similarly not so great for polyps. But the pluses, here's the big plus. You have the patient in the office already. They're showing up at their annual exam. You see they've never done the colonoscopy.
And it's for the refuseniks. It's good for the refuseniks. It's at least something. Something's better than nothing, right?
Right. So I think it fills a void, which is for the people who just can't bring themselves to do a colonoscopy or even to do a colonoscopy. Then we can at least give them something.
Right. And then we have to say, you know, for people who are high risk, you know, they're having gastrointestinal symptoms, they're having that so-called change in their stool consistency. They have a really strong family history. They've had polyps before. They still need a colonoscopy and at certain intervals.
So both Cologuard and this blood test, the specific exclusions are people who are at high risk being worked up with symptoms and so forth. It's not a diagnostic test, it's a screening test.
So finally, Gary, when I'm approaching that age, when can you just forget about all this foolishness and say, hey, you know, I made it to whatever, 75, 80, I'm home free, I don't need a pap smear, I don't need a mammogram, I don't need a colonoscopy, I'm home free.
So I'm going to be the bearer of bad news.
Oh.
Okay, this is my personal read on it, and it is, don't do a test if you wouldn't do anything with the results.
Okay, in other words, important dictum in medicine.
You're ill, you're not well, you know you're not going to be on the earth for another year and a half.
Right.
Why would you do one of these tests?
Yeah.
Right? You're not going to do anything with it. On the other hand, there are some 85-year-olds who are still crushing it. They are so vital. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Should they do something? Of course they should.
Yeah.
And just looking at the surgery data, Ron, the outcome data is irrespective of age. Mm-hmm. It has to do with their underlying protoplasm.
Right.
What's their general health? And if you can assign a scoring system on a 5-point scale, this person is particularly healthy, by all means, do these tests.
Right.
But again, that's a philosophical dilemma. Of course, the tough thing is when the person says, look, I would never be treated for a cancer even if I found one.
Right.
Guess what? When they find that cancer, you know what? They rethink it.
Change their minds. Yeah, right. They do. They do. And finally, you know, this thing with cervical cancer, women get pap smears routinely, they're in the habit of it. I wonder if there's sometimes a little bit of an economic incentive to, you know, have the women come in and get the routine pap smears. Is that medically correct, or is there a certain age where, you know, after a series of negative pap smears and you're negative for HPV, you know, forget about it?
Okay. Thank you for bringing that up. So, first off, the recommendations nationally keep changing. So we went pap smears once a year, then it became once every 3 years. Currently, I think we're at once every 5 years. thrown into
for
that.
For all women at all ages?
No, there's all these exceptions.
Okay, yeah.
And then comes the question of HPV screening. Should that be concurrent? Should that replace the pap smear? Should it be added to the occasional pap smear? And again, there are a series of recommendations nationally thrown out there. I will tell you, you go from GYN office to GYN office, everybody's doing it differently. There is no practical consensus, even if the ivory tower has one. Now, here's my biggest concern. Firstly, the pap smear is the smallest part of the GYN exam. Some people think that's why I'm here, is to get my pap smear. It's not. Don't stop going to the GYN just because you feel you're caught up with your pap smears and don't need it. You still need the annual GYN checkup. We find a ton of other issues. Secondly, there was a recent publication that showed that for the first time ever, the national number of cases of cervical cancer in the United States are rapidly rising.
Rising?
Yes.
And this is with the, well, I guess the vaccine hasn't caught up to older women, HPV vaccine.
Right. And of course, there's conjecture by the author late in the discussion section of the paper. Wonder if this could be related to the progressive infrequency of our recommendations to perform pap smears. I think we've passed the point of safety. I think it's now all about cost, reducing the provision of healthcare to save cost, even if it means more lives are lost and there's a higher incidence of cancers, which I think is just...
Cautionary tale. I just had a patient, unfortunately, who had routine colonoscopies and had had several, and she was told that she could go for 10 years. You know, she was home free. To come back in 10 years. 9 years into it, I think she had a study that was looking at something else. She had some, I don't know, hip problem or something, and they did a CT scan or an MRI, and they saw something. And she had a colonoscopy, and she had... a relatively advanced colon cancer, and she was waiting for that 10-year interval. Right. So, you know, it's kind of a push-pull. It's all about statistics, and no individual is a statistic.
Right. At the 5-year mark, after a whistle-clean colonoscopy, there's a 0% incidence of cancers in the published studies, even though there are precursor polyps. Mm-hmm. So, if you wait till the 10-year mark, there's a 1 to 2% rate of colon cancer.
Right.
So it's not zero.
It's greater than the chance of getting hit by lightning.
by far. I just want to point out also, Ron, that, you know, national recommendations are great if you're treating the nation.
Yeah.
I don't really care.
If you're trying to manage a healthcare system and trying to, deal with the trillions of dollars that we spend on it.
Right. But you and I, and I think most of our listeners, are taking care of individuals, right? So we have to individualize healthcare. Yes, take notice of these recommendations. They come from smart people really thinking through what makes sense. But people break the rules all the time. So for instance, pap smears. Pap smears make sense that you can stop doing it after a certain point if you remain monogamous.
Right.
And so does your partner.
Yeah. And that's problematic sometimes too.
That's not the way life works.
Yeah.
Sometimes, great. Yeah. And not passing any judgment. Sometimes people have other needs and do things and don't tell their spouses, and it puts people at risk. So when the ivory tower analyzes, there are assumptions about behavior that may not play into how an individual acts. So we have to individualize care.
That's very well said. Well, Gary, this has been a fascinating discussion. I think there's very few issues that we've left on the shelf. you have a wealth of knowledge when it comes to dealing practically with a wide variety of women's conditions, PCOS, menopause, ovarian cancer, and certainly breast cancer. And all the maladies that afflict women. And we'll have to get you back on sometime soon to talk about the full range of those conditions, so with a view towards a functional medicine approach, because It's not all about, testing treating conventionally. There are a wide variety of options utilizing functional medicine, which, I commend you because, you've had the great conventional training. You felt that the tools at your disposal were limited in their reach and their efficacy. And so you incorporated a functional medicine perspective, and that enables you to customize treatments in a more effective, less invasive way for most of your patients. So good stuff. Where can people reach you if they want to find out about your practice? You have a website.
Sure. The easiest is website, and that's shockingly GaryGoldmanMD.com.
Okay.
Pretty easy to find. The phone number's on there. Email is on there. We're happy to meet anyone who would care to get amazing care.
And for listening audience who are all over the country, is telemedicine an option these days? Or I think because of the laws in New York State, I ask patients to come to see me. Yeah, at the very least for an initial visit, you have to have a face-to-face.
Right. Now, the good news is I'm also licensed in Florida. So I can also see people who are in Florida by Zoom with no difficulty at all.
Okay, that covers a lot of ground. That sounds good. All right. All the best to you, Gary. It's always great having a discussion with you. I knew that this would be very informative, and I learned a lot, and I hope our audience did as well. So thanks very much for joining us. That's Dr. Gary Goldman. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.
I want to thank you for listening to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or your favorite podcast app, and get new episodes automatically downloaded every weekday. And please give us a rating and review. It truly helps new people discover intelligent medicine. The Intelligent Medicine Podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice, and no doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of information on this podcast or materials linked from this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice for any medical condition they may have and should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions. Finally, please visit drhoffman.com and discover everything Intelligent Medicine has to offer, including frequently updated, unbiased health news and fully vetted product and supplement recommendations.